Okay. All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Good evening. This Sunday is Asarah B'Teves. Now, in the summer, during the 3 weeks, Shivas Ratam was in Tisha B'Av. So the approach is really to mourn. However, I think that Asarah B'Teves at Tzom Gedalia, I don't necessarily know that the mitzvah of that time is necessarily to cry, but it's to do tshuva. Now the question is that when we do tshuva for something that we want, we have to appreciate what we don't have and what we're doing tshuva for, what we'd like to have. Somebody once asked Barbelsky, Zichron Levracha, Rosh Hashiva of Torah Vadas, and also was the camp rabbi of Camp Torah Vadas, as the summer was approaching, how should one prepare for Tisha B'Av? And you might have thought that you should learn about the Churban, the destruction of the temple, to learn about the atrocities, to study the Holocaust, which is what you're really supposed to do on Tisha B'Av itself. However, he said, no, that's for Tisha B'Av. Before Tisha B'Av, a person should learn, maybe Mishnayos Kodshim, to deal with the Korbanot, the sacrifice, and understand the laws. And why is that? Because really, in order to mourn and to appreciate what Tisha B'Av is and these fast days are, it's important to understand what the base of Mikdash, what the temple was. And we don't understand what the temple was, how can we mourn over it? And the truth is that my uncle, Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, said the same thing. Not to take anyone back to Tisha B'Av, but if you remember the kinos on Tisha B'Av, besides the fact that the kinos are very, very long, and as a child, you always remember that once you got to the Tzion kinos, the kinos that begin with the word Tzion, you knew at that point that Baruch Hashem, we're heading towards the end. But my uncle explained that the point of the Tzion Kinos is to describe what was. If you look at Yehuda Levi, what was and what we are missing. Not to describe the destruction, what happened, but what was and what we're missing, because until you know what you are missing, so then you can't really mourn. So even though Asarah B'Teves says it's really a time of tshuva, it's not necessarily a time, and a fasting not necessarily a day of mourning, however, it's still important that we're going to do tshuva to understand what we are missing. I'd like to begin with a story which is quoted by Rav Shimshon Pinkus in a pamphlet he wrote in Yonah Golas V'Nechama, and this comes from the Sefer Lev Elio. Lev Elio was Rav Elio Lapian, who was a mashkiach in Kfar Hasidim, and he found this story in the Torah Sa'olah, Sefer the Ramah. And the truth is, I tried to find actually in the Torah Sa'olah the story, I couldn't find it. I'm curious in itself to understand really how the Ramah can verify such a story, or if the story is just a parable, a mashal. However, whatever it is, the story certainly has a very deep lesson. So back in the days when, in ancient history, when kings would conquer other nations, those members of other nations that had a chance to travel would sometimes travel with their army in order to see the world. And at that time, the Ramah says, traveling with the Babylonian army was a man that we know as Plato, the famous philosopher. And coming to the land of Israel, understand, the land of Israel had scholars. And after the Churban, after the destruction of the temple, he happened to pass by the site of the temple, the Temple Mount, and he saw Yirmiyahu HaNavi, the prophet Yirmiyahu, at the site, and Yirmiyahu had fallen upon the wood and the bricks and was crying. So Pagasho, so Appletown, that's Plato, and he said to him, from the philosophers of Yavin, and he said, you're the wisest of the Jews, the wisest, Atachacham Shebi Yehudim, and you're crying on wooden stones? What is this temple? It's just wooden stones. You should be a little more sophisticated than that. And then he said, and why are you crying on something in the past? You're going to cry about the future, the present, but the destruction happened yesterday, last week. Why are you crying over something that already happened? Smart people don't cry over something that happened already. They look towards the future. Yirmiyahu said, I have a question to ask you. You're a great philosopher. Do you have many shailas, questions in philosophy? So Plato said, I have a lot of shail questions. I don't think anybody can answer these questions. Shemayahu said, you ask me all the questions you have, and I will answer the questions. And Plato asked all the questions, and Shemayahu answered every single question. So at that point, the philosopher was like astounded. He couldn't believe it. Was Shemayahu a man? Was he an angel? And therefore at that point, he said, an angel endowed with great wisdom. And Shemayahu said to him, I want you to know that all my wisdom comes from these stones and wood. All the wisdom comes from the stone and the wood. So you want to know why I'm crying over stones and wood? Because this is where my wisdom, who I am, comes from. And you want to know why I'm crying something that happened in the past? This is something very, very deep. And only a Jew can understand why I'm crying on something in the past. Rak Yehudi, only a Jew, Yachol Lahavin, can understand as omek, the depth of crying on something that happened in the past. And the truth is that I really want to focus on the first answer, that Shemayahu said that these stones and wood is the source of all my wisdom. Where did that come from? Why was the Beis Hamikdash the source, the temple of all of Yirmiyahu's wisdom? Before I proceed to that, I think we should take a few minutes to understand the depth of tears. What are the depths of tears? And a lot of times we know, and this the Maral explains, a lot of times we know that the Jews are supposed to cry. A Jew is supposed to cry. Tisha B'Av, how come? Because since when the Meraglim, the spies, came back from spying out the land of Israel for 40 days, and after they spied out, they came back with a horrible report, and the Jews cried a whole night. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, because you cried for no reason tonight, you will cry for generations on this night. And that night was the ninth of Av, and because they were always supposed to cry on Tisha B'Av to make up for those tears. And what's the idea of those tears that we cried then, and why are we supposed to cry today? And it really connects to this week's parsha, because in this week's parsha, when Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef reveals himself to his brothers after many years of being separated, and he and Binyamin, his brother, his full brother, finally meet. So Torah tells us that Yosef and Binyamin fall on each other's shoulders and they cry. And Rashi asks, why are they crying? Which, in my mind, is probably a very strange question. I don't understand the question. They haven't seen each other many years. Of course they're crying. But Rashi gives another question. Why is the Torah telling us they're crying? It's obvious they would cry. So they weren't just crying over their separation. Rashi explains they were crying over something else. What were they crying about? Binyamin foresaw that the Mishkan Shiloh, the miniature temple that would be in Shiloh until the Bay Temple was built in itself, was in Yosef, was in the area of Yosef, and he saw that that would be destroyed, and therefore Binyamin cried over Yosef's loss. And Yosef saw that the Beis HaMikdash itself, the temple itself, would be in Binyamin, part of it would be Binyamin's area, Nachla, and for that reason, he cried because of destruction of the temple. And in a certain sense, it seems very difficult. They were crying over something that hadn't even happened yet. Not only didn't it happen yet, it wasn't even built yet. Sort of like, you know, you give an example, a certain person, this baby is born, and everyone is so happy, and someone else starts crying. And why is the person crying? Because it's terrible, because in 120 years, this baby is going to die. That's what happens, right? So they're going to cry. So he says, so, and what Yosef Yamin is even more drastic than that. The temple wasn't built. It's like somebody who maybe gets married at the wedding. After the wedding, the bride starts to cry. Why are you crying? Because please God, I'm going to have children, and the children will live a long, healthy life, and then they'll have children, and then they'll live a long, healthy life, but at some point, my grandchildren are going to die, so they start crying. So here, Yosef and Binyamin are crying over a temple that hasn't been built yet, because it's going to be destroyed. What's the idea? Maral explains that a person who cries, they're expressing, it's an automatic reaction about something that seems very strange to them. Very strange. And that's why people cry at sad events. It's very strange that someone should leave this world sometimes, someone you're very close to. And sometimes people cry at very, very happy events. Okay? Some people try to hold themselves in. Some people are more passionate. You know, sometimes a person will cry when they become a parent. At a wedding, something else happens. Why? Because something very strange happened. And crying is a reaction to something that was very, very strange. That's why we cry, the Maral says. That's the point of real tears. So when the Jewish people heard about the report of the Maralim, the spies, they cried. They cried. Why? Because they said the idea of going into Israel at that moment seemed very strange to them. Very strange. And therefore, it was something which came from within. So HaKadosh Baruch God said, you cry over this because you think it's strange? The only way you can go back to the land of Israel is if you realize that not being in Israel is strange. So therefore, you're going to have to cry over not being in Israel. And that's why we have to, that's why Binyamin and Yosef cried. Why did Binyamin cry? Sure, something happened in the future. But when they saw each other, for whatever reason, they thought about the fact that one day the Mishkan, the tabernacle, which would be in Yosef's property, would be destroyed. And for that reason, Yosef, Binyamin cried, because he couldn't imagine a time was so difficult to accept a time when there wouldn't be a tabernacle. And Yosef, whatever he saw Binyamin, he saw a time when the temple would be destroyed, and he cried. Why? Because he couldn't deal with the fact that there would be a time when the temple would be destroyed. And that is what tears are. And that's what Yirmiyahu told Plato. He says, you want to know why I'm crying? You'll never understand. Because you think, just move on and pick up. But I'm crying because I realize that it's very difficult. I can't accept the situation. We won't have a temple. And that's why I'm crying. But that's something you'll never understand because you're a philosopher and you think, you know, just pick yourself up and move on. But we as Jews can't move on. But the important idea is we have to realize that no matter how well we have it, no matter how secure we are, no matter, you know, the economic prosperity that we have to realize that without a temple, there's something very, very wrong, and we have to, in a certain sense, cry. So before the minor fast days, Asar B'Teve is one of them, we have to think about why is a temple, why is the Beis HaMikdash so important to us? What is the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash? So, on one level, you know, because thank God, we all have beautiful shuls, synagogues, we go daven, we pray, nice daven, we feel good. So, do we really need korbanos, the Beis HaMikdash? Well, what's it for? What's the Beis HaMikdash for? We have our shuls that we have to act properly in the shul. So, I just once said that what makes a shul different than a Beis HaMikdash is very simple. You go to any neighborhood, and how many shuls are in every neighborhood? And in Mafia Chemish, there must be, I don't know, over 100 shuls in Ramat B'Shemesh Aleph. I once had to be on a certain yeshuv somewhere, and it was happened to be a Taimani yeshuv at someone's house. I had to catch mincha. And I asked, is there a shul here? And she laughed, because by the Taimanim, he says, like every other family makes their own shul. So there's so many shuls here, right? So many shuls. Says, and all over the world, there's so many shuls. What makes the Beis HaMikdash special is the Beis HaMikdash belongs to every Jew. So there's my shul and there's your shul, but the basement is everybody's. So that's on a national level to appreciate that we should have achdus, unity. That's true. That's something, you know, avas chinam we have to work on. But have an individual level. What did the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, mean for us as individuals? So let's try to understand what the point of the Beit HaMikdash was. If you look at source number 2, I'll translate. This is the Rambam, Maimonides, Hilchot Beis HaBechira, the laws of the temple, Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph, the first halacha. And the Rambam says, mitzvah saseh, it's a positive commandment, lasod bayit l'Hashem, to make a house for God. Muchan liyot makrivim bar karbonos, a place to offer sacrifices. The chogigin olav, and also to go there, sholosh pamim hashana, 3 times a year, and during the sholosh regalim, the 3 holidays, Pesach, Sukkos, and Shavuos, and to also offer a sacrifice, a special sacrifice for those holidays over there, and as opposed to the rest of the year where the Kohanim, the priests are there, the Levim are there, and a few Jews are there. He says, on Chag, on the holidays, everyone's there, so everyone can benefit from the Korbanot, the sacrifices, and everyone can benefit from the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. He says, Shenemar, it says, Asuli Mikdash, you should make me a temple, and therefore many people claim, which is true according to the Rambam, we have an obligation to build the temple, and it's not that we should hope that the temple should come down from heaven, we should build the temple. I'm not going to discuss that right now. So he says, you have to make it's a mitzvah from the Torah to build the temple. And that's in order to offer sacrifices. So someone asked Rav Kook a question. a very strange question in source number 3. He says, let's say, for example, we have an opportunity to build the Beis HaMikdash, but we're not going to be able to offer sacrifices. And what's the problem? The problem is we can't build the Beis HaMikdash, invitation Beis HaMikdash. If we're going to build a Beit HaMikdash, a temple, it has to be for the temple itself. So can a person build a Beit HaMikdash even with the intent of not offering sacrifices? So Rav Kook says, I don't understand. Why would someone build a Beit HaMikdash without intention of offering sacrifices? I guess Rav Kook never envisioned, maybe the anti-cruelty society, animal society standing out and protesting. He said, well, why would someone do that? And they said, because we're impure, we're tamei, we can still be offered sacrifices even in a state of impurity. He says, the bottom line is you built the temple without offering sacrifices. So he says, the person went ahead and he did a mitzvah, he didn't finish it. Alright? However, all you gotta do is be makariv at least one korban, one sacrifice, and then you finish the mitzvah. So we see that the important part of the temple is to offer sacrifices. Okay, we don't have a temple today. We might say the sacrifices, we might say that it's a sacrificial service, you might say the korbanos, but what really are we supposed to get out of the sacrifices? What are we missing in terms of, if that's the purpose of the temple, to have sacrifices, what are we missing that we don't have korbanos? That's the question I'd like to deal with. Before I move on, there is another Rambam, and the Rambam says in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tesis Vayikra. And the Rambam there mentions the machlokas between him, or argument to him, and the Ramban about the point of sacrifices. And the Ramban quotes the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, and he says that what's the reason for sacrifices? Because he says that the early pagan nations, where the Jews lived amongst them, the famous Rambam, so he says they would worship Bucker and so on, they would worship the animals, okay? And he says, he mentions the Mitzrim worshipped the sheep and the Kasdim worshipped the goats. He says, and the bottom line, he says, he mentions, and the same thing today, that those in India, the Ramban says, don't kill animals today even. As a matter of fact, I've never been zocher to be in India. I don't want to go to India, but someone told me that in India you see cows walking on the streets because the cows are the god of some of the people in India. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to make sure we would not be influenced by the pagan nation, said, I want you to shecht these animals to me, all right, in order to know that what they're doing is wrong. And also the Rambam implies that in the Mor Nevuchim that in order not to be inspired or not to be attracted to what the nations did, that they offered sacrifices, we also offer sacrifices. And the Ramban has a lot of difficulty with that, because the Ramban says that if that's the case, then when the Beis HaMikdash is built, there shouldn't be sacrifices anymore. Why shouldn't there be sacrifices anymore? Because no one today is going to be influenced by the Indian, by the people in India, by the Kasdim. Sacrifices are not any longer, part of world religion, except for some people, other ends of the world, some people who are not part of the regular population. So why should there be sacrifices when Mashiach comes? And according to the Rambam, there definitely will be korbanos, because the Rambam says every single mitzvah that is mentioned in the Torah, the Rambam says is a mitzvah for eternity. So he says, he says we know that there were sacrifices that were given even before these nations came along. He says, for example, he mentions that Noach, it says in the Torah, he says, Noach and his three sons, they were makriv a korban. Cain and Hevel were makriv korbanos, sacrifices. And Bilam was offered sacrifices. So therefore, it has nothing to do with other nations, and in a certain sense, making sure the Jews don't get attracted to that religion of other nations. And the Rambam So Ramban, and just, I'm not really going to focus, I will mention Rambam, but Ramban says he believes, and at the very end of source number 4, that the reason for Kurbanos is because, he says, that our actions are done by our thoughts, and our speech, and by actions. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded that we go ahead, and therefore why do we do things? We do things wrong because our actions, our thoughts, and our speech. So therefore, when we go ahead and we bring a korban, we should go ahead and put our hands on the korban, an animal, and to atone for an action that was wrong. We should say vidui, confession on the animal, to atone for the speech that we did that was wrong, and then we should go ahead and we should burn the animal, so the kidneys. Which represent the desire and the thoughts of a person to atone for our thoughts and desires that are wrong, and then the legs because we ran to do an avera, and you sprinkle the blood to atone for the fact that when we did a sin we did it with our nefesh, our soul, and we do this, we should realize how much sin that the Kaddish bar against God, and therefore hopefully we will gain atonement with this. Okay, we'll come back. The Rambam. But the question is to understand the Rambam. And I think the major question is that if the Rambam holds the reason that we have to go ahead and we have to offer sacrifices is in order to make sure we're not attracted to other pagan religions, where is there a place for sacrifices today? Okay. So, hopefully we'll put it together. So therefore, I think in order to understand the question, to answer the question, we have to understand what are the points of sacrifices. And obviously, if you want to look in the Torah, and we want to see what a point of sacrifice is, you can probably find in many different places the point of a sacrifice. And understanding what a sacrifice is very difficult. As a matter of fact, it's not on the sheet, but the Rambam points out, say for Kutchim, he points out that really the point of the Rambam and Yad HaChazakah, that the point of the sacrifice is we can't understand. So on one hand, the Rambam says in Moreh Nevuchim, the point of the sacrifice is to make sure that we're attracted to pagan nations. On the other hand, the Rambam says the Yad HaChazakah, the point of the sacrifices, I think it's in Hilchos Me'ila, he says, but I don't have it in front of me, is we don't understand. There's something very hidden going on, and it affects us in a certain way. So the Michtav Me'ilo says, Michtav Me'ilo points out, in the days when the Torah was given, there were two reasons. One is there was a hidden reason, and another reason was it affects us in a certain way. In other ways, the reason why we shouldn't be attracted to other pagan nations, other pagan religions. But today, the reason is only because there's something very hidden, which we'll try to explain. So I thought, in order to understand Korbanos, maybe we should look at the first sacrifice that was ever offered. Okay? And that's not mentioned in the Torah. That's mentioned in the Chazal. And that's source number 5. It's the Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah. So Tana Rabbanan, Yom Shenivra Bo Adam Arishon, the day that Adam Rishon was created. So what happened? We know on that day, he sinned. He ate from the Eitz Hadas. So Kevon Sheshakol of Chama, once the sun set, Amar, he says, Oili, woe to me, Shebishvil Shesarachti Olam, Sharachti. So he says, because I went bad, I did one Avera, one sin, so Olam Choshech Ba'adi, the world has become dark, and now the world has become dark. He is afraid the world will return to its previous state of confusion. He never saw darkness. The Yachshur Olam Atovavo. So Vizuhi Misa, and this is the death. Shenikneso Olam and Hashemayim. This is the death that has been decreed against me from the heavens. So Adam, according to this Gemara, a whole night was very concerned that the world was coming to an end. He was sitting and fasting, Uboch and crying, Kolalila, the Chava and Chava, Boch and Kenegdo, was crying, facing him, and Cave and Sha'olam Urashachar, as soon as it was dawn, Amar, he says, Ah, Minhago Sha'olamu, this is the nature of the world, there's day, there's night, there's day, the Amar Behikrib Shor, he went ahead and he offered a shore, an ox, Shekarichnav, Kolmul and Parsosav, where the horns preceded the hoofs. We know usually when a person is created, so usually the body comes first, the horse comes later. But here the Gemara says, karnav, the horns, preceded the hoofs, the rest of the body. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, v'teidel l'Hashem yishor par mikarnav paras. It says that a korban should be better than the short Adam Rishon offered. So what's the idea of karnosav kolm l'parsosav? So the Maral in Chiddush Agados on that Gemara, source number 8, so he points out like this. He says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu bara min ha-behemos v'hu yisbarach gozer mashpia ha-chashem kodem. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu went ahead, and when he created the behemos, he created the more chashem that was first, and he says, and the more chashem is closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the less chashem, the less important part, is farther away. And therefore, he says, the karnosav, which are closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to God, okay, were created first, as opposed to karnosav, as opposed to the hoofs, which were created later. And I was thinking about this, that what does the horns represent that is closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? It doesn't just mean closer in space, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is everywhere. And I was thinking that the human being is actually quite complex, and the human being is made of passion and intellect. The Ibn Ezra in Koheles Perigimel, he says the Ibn Ezra points out that Perigimel Pasigimel, he says Tov Kas Mischok Kibroa Panimi Tavlev. He says the Ibn Ezra says that anger is better than laughter, because having a face of sadness makes the heart better. And he says and then he goes on, and he's basically talking against being too happy. And Ibn Ezra on that pasuk speaks about how a man is created, and he speaks about the man has what's called the nefesh hatzomachas. That's, you know, the soul of a person that, you know, needs nourishment. It's called eating and drinking, which is similar to a plant, which also needs nourishment. And then there's a nefesh habahamis, which is the animalistic part of our nature, which more gives us movement as animals move. And then there's the neshama, the intellect. And he says a person has to go through life, and he starts off basically with the nefesh hatzomachas. He needs to eat and drink and sleep, he or she, and then the nefesh habahamis is moving and it's very strong, and then later on he's endowed with the neshama, the intellect, and somehow the intellect has to some level subdue, has to go in and subdue the nefesh hatzomachas, and the nefesh habahamis is when to go, when to eat, when to fill your passions and your desires. That's the Ibn Ezra. And therefore he says that sometimes you say you want to be very happy, sometimes maybe it's not so good to be happy. Maybe Tov Kas Mischok. Maybe when you see someone acting in an improper way, maybe it's important to be upset and to realize that people shouldn't behave this way. And sometimes it's good to be happy, but we have to go ahead and know of our intellect how to control our passions. And I was thinking that maybe this is the point of the Beis HaMikdash, and this is certainly the point of the Korbanos, the sacrifices. There is a famous Mishnah, Maseches Yuma and a Gemara. And the Mishnah Maseches Yuma, Tarek Beis Mishnah Bet, tells a story. So you know, when the Kohanim would come to the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, every single day. So there were a certain amount of shifts, and every shift had their week. It was 2 weeks a year. And then every day, every shift had its sub-shifts. And they would come their day of the week, and then there was only a certain amount of physicians available to be participate in the avoda and the service of the temple. So what would they do? So now, not now, but at some point, they instituted a system, was called the pious, and they would have a lottery, and the Kohanim who won the lottery, they would have opportunity to participate in the sacrifices. However, before that, it seemed like it was, as they say, a balagan. What was a balagan? That whoever could get to the mizbeach first, he would win, and he would be able to get, he would be able to be involved in, let's say, the trumas hadeshin and other acts of the korban. So the Mishnah says, in source number 7, that once it happened, shahayu shneim shavim, that two kohanim were running, and it was neck. They were neck and neck. Okay, it's not, he says, so what happened? And they're going up the ramp to the Mizbeach. V'dachat echot mehen es chavero, and one of them pushed his friend off the ramp, v'nafal, and he fell, v'nishma raglo, and he broke his leg. Cave and Shiro, Bezdin, once Bezdin saw that, you know, this contest to see who's first is going to cause injury, so Bonal de Sakana, Hiskinu, they made a takana, Shalo Yehe Torbman Esamizbeach Alabapayas, they would only go ahead and decide who gets to clean the Mizbeach every day through a lottery. That's the Mishnah. But it's not over. The Gemara, in source number 8, on Chav Gilman Aleph, Mesechus Yuma, tells a story. My says that Mike's action with two Kohanim that were neck and neck running up the ramp, and one of them was, you know, somehow or another got into the Arba Amos, four Amos of his friend, and, you know, he thought he was going to lose. So what did he do? It's a terrible story, okay? It's very hard to read a story without expressing passion. He says he took a knife and he stuck the knife in the heart of his other Kohen. As Mara says, Natal Saki B'Tavala B'Libo. So he says, so Ahmad Rabbi Tzadok Amala Se'ulam, Rabbi Tzadok got up and said, wow, this, by the way, this seems like this Rabbi Tzadok lived, I think, towards the end of maybe the Bayis Sheni. He's got Amala Se'ulam, and he says, Achenu Beis Yisrael Shemoa. There's a halacha that if you find a dead body somewhere, you find a dead body somewhere, so between two cities, you don't know which city it came from, but the city where it's close to has to bring a calf and break its neck in order to have atonement for the city. So he says, but who's going to bring the Egla Arufa here for the Beis HaMikdash? Is it the city of Yerushalayim or the Beis HaMikdash? Who's going to bring it? So all the nation started to cry. And the Gemara says, explains what was going on. He was trying to say what a tragedy when someone is killed. And for that reason, that since someone was, he says, we have to bring an Egla Rufa, which says how tragic is, we can't let bloodshed just fly by us. And here this happens in the temple, and like, no one blasts an eyelash. That's an eyelash. So then what happened? The father of the one that was killed came, and he saw that his son was still, there was still a pulse, which means that the son didn't die yet. So he says, so what did he say? He said, this is the kapara. My son's alive, and therefore this knife, which is a knife of the Beis HaMikdash, has not become tummy, because it's not in the body of somebody who was dead. So he says, then what happened? Purity of the vessels in the temple was so important to them, at this moment it was even more important than life. So he says, and we see that unfortunately happened during various times in our history. Okay, so because of that, they said, this is terrible, this is absolutely horrible, and we have to change the system, we're going to have a system of lottery. That's what Bezdin said. So he says like this. So he says, so now there were two incidents, one where someone was killed, and one where someone was murdered, or where someone broke his leg. Which one came first? So if you want to tell me that the situation of murder came first, so once someone was murdered, how could they go ahead and continue this system and only stop once someone's leg was broken? Doesn't make sense. So obviously it must be that someone's leg was broken first. So someone's leg was broken first. How did the situation happen with the murder? So Mara says that first the person, the Kohen that was murdered happened first. And they thought it was Yotze Dofen. Something just happened. It wouldn't happen again. When we saw it happened again, so they said, okay, we have to make a change. And the question is that, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that this system's not going to work. And even after someone broke a leg, right? I'm sorry, even after someone was killed, why'd they continue? So it happened once in 1,000 years. That's enough to stop. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Lebracha, who once wrote, I believe, that he said like this, what I understand from many years ago when I saw this, that as hectic and as disorganized as it sounds, there was something positive about the race. Because you're racing to something, there's a certain excitement and a certain passion, as opposed to just walking. It's a certain passion. And the Chachamim at that time felt that this passion for the Beis HaMikdash was so important. And for that reason, since it was so important, they decided that they wanted to keep it going. Someone was killed, a terrible tragedy. It was probably Yossi Dofen, it will never happen again. So let's keep the excitement. And having excitement of Beis HaMikdash was very important. As a matter of fact, in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, when we speak about the sins of the sons of Eli, so what were the sins of the sons of Eli? Eli was the high priest, and his son sinned, and because his son sinned, so the right of priesthood, the high priesthood was taken from the family, and the family was subjected to terrible punishment. So what did they do? So the Pasukim say what they did was that when the meat was cooking for a person, you know, who brought a korban, they would go and grab the meat that they felt was entitled to them, and they would grab the fork and not treat it respectfully. And was that such a great sin? The answer was people were not excited anymore to come to the Beis HaMikdash because somehow the way the Kohanim treated them and treated their korban, it took away all the excitement. And that was a terrible sin that they had to. They had to excite the people to the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore Lacham also wanted people to be excited. They wanted a passion, they wanted excitement, and there's no question that that was the point of the Beis HaMikdash, to write, arouse excitement for the Beis HaMikdash for service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, service of God. There's a Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra, the Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph, and there the Gemara talks about the Yeshua ben Gamla. Who was Yeshua ben Gamla? Yeshua ben Gamla was the first person who believed in forced education of children. He said he didn't like the idea. He said you have to have a system of schools so children can learn. Because he said at that point it seems that anyone who had a father who could teach would teach a son Torah, and someone did not have a father, or a father who couldn't teach wouldn't learn Torah. It wasn't a good system. So he decided that what they're going to do is they're going to have to, every father to bring their child to learn in school. So later on, the takana enactment was to have a school in every area. But at first he said, in Bava Basra Rav Chaf Alman Aleph, that you have to do it in Yerushalayim. So he says, to Amar Rav Yehuda Marav, Baram Zachar Osi Yishlatov, remember that person for good. Yeshua ben Gamla Shmo, his name is Yeshua ben Gamla. Shilmoli Hu, because if not for him, I know he's more about English, if not for him, not for Yeshua ben Gamla, so what's going to happen is, education would have, we would have gone ahead, and we, Torah would have forgotten in Klal Yisrael. Why? Because as I said, the Gemara says that a father would go ahead and a father would teach his son Torah, but if a child did not have a father to teach him, he wouldn't learn Torah. So he said, bring him to Yerushalayim. What happened? It turned out, Gemara says, that those who had fathers would bring him to Yerushalayim. Those who didn't have fathers would be stuck at home. So the whole enactment did not help. So finally they said, okay, let's have in every single area. So, but why Yerushalayim? So the Gemara says, when it comes to Yerushalayim, the Gemara points out, he says, Ki Mitzion Toitzei Torah, the Torah should come from Sion, and where's Sion? Yerushalayim? So the Torah for children should come from Yerushalayim. So Tosfos in source number 10 points out, why? Why Yerushalayim? Why not? Why originally only Yerushalayim? Originally should have had in every center, all over the country. So there's something about Yerushalayim. Why? Because Lafisha Yeroa Kedusha Gedola. Because in Yerushalayim you see a great holiness. The Kohanim Oskim Bavoda, and Kohanim are involved in Avoda. Hayumachavin Libo Yoser, he'll be more focused, Lira Shemayim, to have fear of heaven, Lomo Torah. Kedarshinam Visifri, in other words, so therefore the bottom line is that, and that's why Tosis goes on, that Meister Shani, eating Meister Shani brings Lima Torah. What's Meister Shani? Meister Shani is that there's a 7-year Shemitah cycle. There's the year of Shemitah, and then the first and second and fourth and fifth year of the Shemitah cycle, you're supposed to take 10% eating Yerushalayim. And the Gemara says, Tosfos quotes, that Meister Shani brings learning Torah. Why does Meister Shani bring someone to learn Torah? How come? Why? Because when you bring the Meister Shani to Yerushalayim, you see the Kedusha, the holiness in Yerushalayim. So he says, everyone's involved in serving God, it will inspire someone to learn Torah. And therefore we wanted to inspire a child to learn Torah, to be passionate, and that passion should affect someone and have someone learn Torah. So there's no question that the point of the korbanos, the point of the sacrifices, on some level, is to inspire, to imbue a person with certain passion. However, the problem is passion is not enough. Okay, why isn't passion enough? Passion is not enough because, unfortunately, if all you have is passion, you can do something, you can go ahead and you can do something wrong. And therefore, besides passion, and passion is what comes at the very beginning of a person's life, something you desire, really want. But however, you have to have what's called intellect. Okay, you have to have what's called intellect. Intellect is sort of in the neshama to decide what's right and what's wrong. Sometimes passion can lead a person wrong. And therefore, and intellect is what brings us in a certain level closer to God. As a matter of fact, the Rambam says that how does a person become a Navi? There's a long process, but that's perfection of the intellect. Okay, so therefore, I was thinking that maybe if we speak about the animal itself presents the nefesh atzamachas, the life-giving force, the passion, the desire, and the karnos of the horns, which came before, which Adam sacrificed, represents what's closer to God, and that is the intellect. Because with our intellect, we can connect our Kadosh Baruch Hu. When a person reaches perfection on that level, and as a matter of fact, when a person wants to connect to God at the highest level, he has to sort of mute his desires, his passion, his passions might take him to there, but he has to have his intellect. And therefore, the korban symbolizes the passion and the intellect together. There's a Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin says that when someone has Deya, Das, it's Ki'ilu, the temple is built in whole his day. When you have Deya. What does Deya mean? What is Deya? So, Deya, we know, is Das, knowledge. It's a combination of Chacham and Bina. So on one of the Svarim, it's very nice when a person has wisdom, that's chachma. A person has intuitive knowledge. But the question is, you have to know how to apply it. There's a mashal of a certain king that had a very foolish son. And this was going to be his son that was going to inherit his throne. And he was very nervous about having this son inherit his throne. So what did he do? The king sent off his son to university for many, many years. And the son came back with a doctorate. I don't know what subject, but a doctorate. And then, after many years coming back, the king held a big party for his son. He's very proud of his son. And then, a question came up. What to do? And he said, okay, let my son decide. So they asked the son the question, and he sits down, you know, He learned engineering, he learned physics, he was making all these calculations, and he came to some ridiculous answer. It doesn't mean, I'm just saying, having him. He says, it's very nice to have knowledge and have intuitive wisdom, but if you don't have das, you don't know how to apply that knowledge, that's a problem. Gemara's Mishnah Medrash says that in Vayikra, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu called Moshe, Yikar Shel Moshe, and we don't see it again. So the Medrash says, Moshe Rabbeinu after that should have figured it out. And the Medrash uses a very strong lashon, that somebody who does not have knowledge, a nevela, a dead carcass, is better than him. What's knowledge? Knowledge is in order to know how to use that wisdom. We learn Torah, we should know how to use the Torah. We have to know how to use it. And I think that, in a certain sense, the Beis HaMikdash is a place where we have to come to know how to use the knowledge. And knowledge that you know how to use is a very, very strong knowledge. Theoretical wisdom is nice, but when you learn something and you have to apply it, there's no question you have a much better understanding and a much better handle on that knowledge. I know myself, personally, things that I learned when I was learning for Smicha, and then it comes up Lamais as an action, you have to look it up again, all of a sudden it becomes ingrained with you, applying it. And I think that that's what Yirmiyahu HaNavi told Plato the philosopher. He said, you want to know why I'm crying over eights and wood and stones? You want to understand this? because this Beis HaMikdash, this temple, when he offered sacrifices, it gave me a sense of passion, desire, and but also how to use the desire, how to control it. That was the sacrifice, because the truth is the sacrifices, yes, they come from a sense of sacrifice, a desire, a sense of we desire certain things, and it teaches us how to channel desire, because even though you might desire something, there are some very strict laws in regard to sacrifices. You have to watch what you think, how long it lasts. Korbanos, even though it comes from a sense of passion, as Ramban says, thinking that you're on the Mizbeach, you're on the altar, but it teaches you a certain sense, also of intellect, how you have to control it. That those are the two points of the horns, the intellect, and the desire. There's a Sfas Emes, which I mentioned very quickly last time, which is very applicable, so I want to spend a little more time on it. And the Sfas Emes, it's the very beginning of Parshas Vayera. The beginning of Parshas Vayera, we're told Vayera, HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared to Avram after his bris milah in the tents of the plains of Mamre. And look, we don't see anywhere else in the Torah HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared to Avram here. Where do we see HaKadosh Baruch Hu says he appeared in a certain person's place? So Chazal tell us, the rabbis tell us, that Avram Avinu had three friends. Who were his three friends? His three friends were Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, God said to Avram, Avram, I want you to do a bris milah, I want you to do a sacrifice. So Avram Avinu, before he did this, I want you to do a bris milah, I want you to circumcise yourself. So before Avram went and circumcised himself, he went to ask advice from his three friends, what they thought. Avram didn't ask advice before the Akedah, only by the Bris Milah. So, very difficult. Why did he ask advice before the Bris Milah? Hashem says, you do Bris Milah, you do Bris Milah. And he went to Aner and Eshkol, and they said, Avram, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea. Don't do Bris Milah. It's crazy. They went to Mamre. Mamre says, listen, Avram. His name is still Avram. Not Avram yet. Maybe was Avram already because he had changed. Avram. Avram, he says, I don't know, but if God says do bris milah, do bris milah, and that's it. There's nothing to talk about. So Avram Avinu goes and he does the bris milah. And because of that, a certain reward, HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared to Avram in the plains of Mamre. So now, for eternity, every child knows about Mamre. So, I'm not sure if I learned Vayera in second grade or in third grade, but I heard about Mamre when I was a little boy. Aner and Eshkol took me some time until I got acquainted with Aner and Eshkol. So, actually, he's mentioned all the Erbali Bris Avraham, but Mamre is very famous. And they're also mentioned, but Mamre is very famous. So, and the question, the Sfas Emes asked the question, like, why do they deserve a reward? Why do they deserve a reward? Because he gave Avram Avinu advice to have Bris Milah? Literally, he says, it was no skin off his back. He didn't do anything. He just had a Bris Milah. So the Sfas Emes says, it was. What was Avram Avinu concerned about? What was he concerned about? Avram Avinu saw his role, that his role at that moment was to inspire the world, to change the world. And he saw they had three, had friends. He was able to talk to people. In some level, he was similar to them. But he felt, once I do Bris Milah, all of a sudden, the Jew is going to become different. And maybe once I'm different, I won't be able to inspire people. And Avram Avinu said, Amri says, that's what Aner Eshkol said, yeah, for sure. As a matter of fact, we're afraid that if you have Bris Milah, we won't connect to God also. We want to connect. They had a passionate desire. Mamre said, listen, I think I'm going to miss out on something, but if God says, you got to do what God says. That's intellect. And I've learned that. And then immediately afterwards, HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared in Mamre's area, the plains of Mamre. So Mamre himself benefited from the Bris Milah. Why? Because as great and as wonderful as passion is, I'll give an example of certain types of passion, but we have to combine it with intellect. When I was growing up, so one of the visions I have, still growing, but when I was, but visions I have, I remember coming home from I remember seeing, not coming home, but no matter how late I went to bed, even as a high school boy, my father was always up learning. And no matter how early I got up, he was up learning. I'll tell you, there were certain days I went to bed very late. And there were certain days I went and got up very early. And he was always up. I remember one time I had to register at college, so I had to daven at 6 o'clock minyan. You know, you think you come down a quarter to 6, and you know, he's learning of his cup of tea, okay? He slept, I know he slept. I used to hear him say Shema at night, but sometimes. Hey. And then my father had a stroke, and he still got up very early, but he used to get up a little bit earlier because he was tired. And I used to have a chavrusa with somebody, yeshiva till 12 o'clock at night. And there was one night I was actually very tired, and I told him, I said, I'm going home early, I'm exhausted. And I walked in the house at 11:20, and there was my father learning at the table, which I hadn't seen in a long time. Even though I was exhausted, somehow ignited a passion, a desire to learn. Passion, desire is a wonderful thing. It's wonderful. But unfortunately, sometimes passion, desire can take us the wrong way. And sometimes that passion, desire, we might not learn what we're supposed to learn. We might not retain what we're supposed to retain. And the Beis HaMikdash had both. The Korbanos had a certain passion, desire. That was the point. But even when you have the passion, desire, we're told, whatever passion, desire we have to eat the Korbanos, to sacrifice the Korbanos, we have to know, we have to understand that there has to be intellect that comes along. And intellect is even more important. And Yirmiyahu, and therefore today, when we don't have the Kazdim and the Mitzrim, but the Korbanos themselves, we see the Korbanos, it'll inspire us for impassion. Someone says to me, how are the Korbanos going to push somebody today? So I say that, and I always say, I don't understand something. You think you're not going to be inspired by it? I had a discussion with someone in America this summer. Man in his 40s, can I ask you a question? Do you ever go to movies? Says, of course I go to movies. I said, do you ever go to a rated R movie? She says, Rabbi, just tell me the truth. He says, yes. I said, obviously the rated R movies you go to, they're rated R because there's a lot of violence, people are being killed. I said, when you see someone being killed, do you look with your eyes gouging out at that? He says, yeah. I said, how do you look at a murder like that? I don't understand. Where's your sense of humanity? He says, it's only a movie. I said, but it should bother you. So you see, there's something going inside you that I can't explain, and everybody else. A certain passion, desire to see, to do something which could be channeled the wrong way or channeled the right way. So therefore, the Beis HaMikdash teaches us to channel desires. And by the way, that was my father's yesod, not my yesod. I heard it from my father. He says, that was, I asked my father once. And that's something we still have today. So you go and you have a korban, and it ignites a certain passion. How does it ignite a certain passion? I have to tell you, you see people get so excited about the simonim, the fruits we eat on Rosh Hashanah night, the rimonim and the dates and the fish, and myself included. And you have to have as much as you can have, 10 of these things on the table, even though according to the Ramah, apple and honey is enough, right? And people get so excited, and people say the Yiratzon with such kavana. Like, what is going on? Okay, I include myself in this. He says, why? Because somehow or another, it's not a mitzvah, it's a minhag. It ignites a certain passion. Sacrifice ignites a certain passion. However, the intellect also says, you know, got to make sure you make the right bracha, eat in the right way, what's the right order, and that the Beis HaMikdash teaches us. Harsosav kodem, karnosav kodem harsosav. Passion is very important, but intellect comes first. And that's what Yirmiyahu said to Vleita. You want to know where a course comes from? It comes from learning all this, because I had a passion, but because intellect, I knew to focus on the right things. And I'm afraid that I'd be missing out on that now about a Beis HaMikdash, about a temple. So as we prepare for Asara B'Teves, and we hope that maybe the fast days will cease to exist, we have to show, and that's Deya. Deya means that if you have Deya, you have a temple. It means after you have everything, the passion, you have the intellect to put it together, to know how to serve God, to combine the both. That's what you need in the Beis HaMikdash, and that's what I learned from the temple, Yirmiyahu said. So it behooves all Jews to try to understand, even though we don't have it, but try somehow to grasp at some level the passion and intellect to somehow experience and to desire the base ministry where we'll once be able to develop the proper passion and to somehow have it controlled by the proper intellect and therefore know the exact way to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu.